Don't waste time on emotions that don't do you any good.
Do I call you Lady Justice?
You can just call me Justice. Well, you tell me what a sandwich is, and then I'll tell you if a hot dog is a sandwich. When will there be enough women on the court? And my answer is, when there are nine. The two people love each other, and both are women or both are men. Why should the law put up a no sign?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 447. I'm Thomas, and that is Andrew Torres. How you doing, sir?
I am fantastic, but I'm extra fantastic. We are having back one of our favorite guests, and a little different OA this time.
Yeah. Just a quick refresher on our announcements. That fundraiser, it is happening December 20th. That's a Sunday. Be ready. Be ready to come watch, hang out, see some great guests, and of course, donate to save democracy.
I can't think of anything more important than that. Yeah, Sunday, December 20th, Opening Arguments, live fundraiser to save the Republic.
All right, well, with that said, you may remember an episode a few... you remember us from such episodes as debating over Professor Randall Eliason's Washington Post opinion column about whether or not we should prosecute Trump. Well, Professor Randall Eliason was kind enough to come on our show and talk about it. And we're so excited to have him. Very curious to see if our episode influenced him at all, or maybe if Andrew's arguments will influence him in the moment. We'll find out. Let's go ahead and get on the line with Professor Randall Eliason. And we are joined by Professor Randall Eliason. So glad you are coming on the show. Hoping it's, you know, not just to yell at us and then rage quit. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Oh, doing great. We're so glad to have you. I think this is a very worthwhile discussion and argument to have, regardless of if we still disagree. But seeing as how we did a full episode without you here, you know, discussing our, you know, our objections and stuff, think it makes sense and is fair to let you go ahead and have the opening word here. So why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed most of your episode last week when discussing my, I won't say all of it, but you did not convince me to change my mind. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to come back and see if I can convince you. So to start with, I want to make like three or four kind of big picture points, and then I'll go to those five separate points that Andrew talked about in my column. The first big picture point is I agree with most of what you said. As I said in the piece, I think this is a difficult decision. I think it's a close call, and I think there's good arguments on both sides, and many of which you made. I just think that there are costs to either approach. There are costs to pursuing him as well as to not pursuing Trump, and I just come down on the side of thinking that the costs of pursuing him are higher. And so when deciding what's in the best public interest going forward, that's why I argue that that would be to not pursue Trump as opposed to pursuing him. But it's not that I don't recognize the force of the arguments on the other side, and I said that in the piece as well. The second big picture point is we're talking just about the president here. So there were some comments during your discussion about, you know, we have a problem with corruption in politics. The answer isn't to not prosecute the criminals. Again, I agree with that. I used to prosecute corruption cases for a living, so I take them pretty seriously. So I'm not arguing for some kind of get-out-of-jail-free card for all corrupt politicians, as maybe was suggested at times. There are considerations that are unique to the president, and that's what I'm talking about here. The third is there were a number of times during your program when you said, I want to know what happened. Don't you want to know what happened? And again, yes, I agree with that. We want to know what happened about COVID, Russian interference, whatever. I want to know too. The problem is that's not the role of criminal law. And a criminal investigation is actually the worst way to find that out. The purpose of a criminal case is not to inform people. It's to investigate criminal allegations. And due to grand jury secrecy, the public really doesn't learn about it, especially if a case ends up not being brought. Those proceedings remain secret. You have to remember the Mueller report was unusual because it was a special counsel. Mm-hmm. But in general, a criminal case is the worst way to try to inform the public about what happened. So what you're arguing for, in my mind, is congressional investigations. And right. I think that's great. I said that in the piece, too, because those are public and those can lead to reforms, legislation, so we make sure this stuff doesn't happen in the future. But I want to know what happened, which was repeated multiple times during your broadcast, is kind of irrelevant to my argument, because that a criminal investigation is never the answer to I want to know what happened. And then the fourth big picture point is I just want to reject or push back on this kind of binary view that's not only in your podcast, but in a lot of commentary these days, that either we're saying something was criminal and we're going to prosecute it, or we're saying it's okay, we don't care, it was fine. No harm, no foul. And that's just not right. There's a lot of sleazy, immoral, bad stuff that happens that isn't criminal. I think we talked about this before when we talked about Bridgegate, and people were saying, oh, the Supreme Court said it's fine if they caused that traffic jam and, you know, endangered all those people. It's no big deal. And that's not what they were saying. They were just saying it wasn't a federal felony. And there's still a lot of bad conduct that isn't criminal. And that's where I put most of Trump's misconduct. There's also additional remedies, even in cases where you think it arguably was criminal. There are other remedies possible. In this case, you know, when Trump leaves office, he's going to be facing a barrage of litigation. You know, civil cases, the IRS can go after him civilly for taxes. You know, the women who said he's sexually assaulted them are suing him. State investigations, both civil and criminal, those New York State criminal cases, you know, those are all going to be going on. It's not that he's going to not face any consequences for all the things we've heard about. So the only question here is now, on top of all that, do we want a federal criminal prosecution as well? All right. So now quickly about the five kind of points that Andrew split up the column into. The first was my statement that we don't use the criminal justice system to punish political opponents. And I referred to the locker up chance, and I know that made you guys a little angry. So if you don't like the locker up comparison, how about another Clinton? If you don't like that example, let's look at Bill Clinton. So Bill Clinton could have been charged with perjury when he left office. In fact, that was probably an easier case than the obstruction case against Trump. But it didn't happen. And we have this tradition of not prosecuting sitting presidents after they leave office. So I'm talking about a principle and whether we should set a precedent or change that precedent. Now, I agree Trump makes it difficult to defend that principle because his conduct is so outrageous and potentially seems more criminal than many. Although I think not as clear as you do, and we'll discuss that later when it comes to obstruction. But the principle is against even suggesting using prosecution as a way to go after the outgoing administration, which is done in a lot of other countries routinely, you know, and I don't think we want to become like those countries. So with all the other norms that have been shattered, this one hasn't been shattered yet. Even Bill Barr and Jeff Sessions weren't willing to go that far. You could easily imagine if Trump had a Trumpier AG when he first took office, a criminal investigation of Obama for spying on his campaign, for example, right? But it didn't happen. And I don't think we should be the ones to start down that road. Now, you feel like it's different because here it's so clear Trump committed crimes, but Hillary didn't. And so that justifies it. And my response to that is just to sort of, with respect, suggest that you think about that liberal bubble that you talk about on your show from time to time. Half the country feels just the opposite, right? Half the country feels just as strongly as you do that, in fact, Hillary and Obama were criminals and that Trump did nothing wrong and is being persecuted. So we're talking about a perception here in half of the country that DOJ is being even further politicized, that it's now used to go after political opponents, and that's going to just compound the terrific harm that Barr and Trump have already done to the Department of Justice and its reputation for independence. So, you know, in 4 or 8 years, when the shoe's on the other foot and you've got some new Republican president prosecuting Biden for some policy, you know, disagreement or, you know, whatever they want to try to come up with, it's not going to matter if the liberals can all say, well, that's unfair. You know, it's okay to prosecute Trump, but this is unfair because it's not criminal. because half the country is going to disagree with you. So it's just the issue of creating that precedent and then, again, further politicizing the Department of Justice that I'm worried about. Point two was we don't prosecute norms, and we pretty much agreed on that. It's got to be clearly criminal conduct, not just norms. And the fact is, though, that almost all of Trump's misconduct, I think, falls into this category. There's very little that's really arguably potentially criminal. And you talked about the emoluments clause as an example that I put in my column. And you said, yeah, but wouldn't you like to know what happened? Isn't there some way to make that a crime? And again, those are all excellent reasons for a congressional investigation to look into the emoluments violations, pass reform legislation. There's already been some proposed, in fact. So yeah, let's investigate. Let's find out what happened, but not with a criminal process. The third point, obstruction. I talked about how the House didn't even bother to impeach. And Andrew called that an own goal on my part, because he said just the opposite. It's because they didn't impeach that we need to prosecute. We need to counter that no obstruction, no collusion narrative. And again, I get that argument, but I just don't agree with it. And I stand by the own goal and say, I think it's relevant. I think it's relevant. It's not decisive. It doesn't decide whether you should prosecute or not. But to me, it's relevant that the House did not even bother to impeach. The Constitution contemplates prosecution after impeachment and removal. It expressly says that. Once you're removed from office, you can be prosecuted. It's a little odd to say this conduct wasn't serious enough to even bother trying to remove the president from office, where the standard of proof is so much lower. But now we're going to try to put him in jail for the same conduct 2 or 3 years later, now that he's out of office. If it were that serious, you'd think you'd at least try to remove him from office. So it's not because lack of impeachment means that he wasn't guilty, but I think it is relevant to the idea of whether it's in the public interest now to reopen this and try to put the president in jail for conduct that the Democrats wouldn't even try to remove him from office for. And they can't respond by saying, well, it was pointless because the Republicans control the Senate, because they did it with Ukraine, right? So they can't just say, well, we would never impeach him for anything because it wasn't worth it. Because they did it with Ukraine. So to me, that still remains a relevant factor. Again, not because it means he wasn't guilty, but when you're exercising your prosecutorial discretion about what kind of cases to pursue, the country has kind of closed the book on the obstruction of justice. And I think there's a good argument that it's not in the public interest to reopen it. The fourth point was agenda setting. And I think you sort of agreed with this one. Do you want to make the next few years all about Trump? I want him to fade away as much as possible. I know it's not going to happen, but one thing we can guarantee if he's prosecuted is that he's going to stay in the spotlight and continue his agenda of victimhood and grievance day after day about this new witch hunt. And, you know, you suggest it's an open and shut obstruction case he'd be indicted and it'd be a quick guilty plea or something. I mean, that's just not going to happen. Eric Posner, a pretty highly regarded law professor at Chicago, wrote a column in the New York Times about a week after mine that I sent to Andrew, sort of making the same arguments about why Trump should not be prosecuted. And he pointed out a lot of the legal issues with an obstruction of justice case. There are a lot of constitutional defenses because he's the president again that don't apply to anybody else. But best case is it goes for 2 or 3 years. It ends up being acquitted, or even if you get him convicted, he's either then a martyr or a victim. Right. Either way, you're just keeping the spotlight on him. Everything's all about Trump. And I don't think that's what we want. Related to that response was, I think Thomas said, you know, this idea that that Biden can pursue his agenda and we can have unity doesn't make any sense. That's not going to happen no matter what. Nixon's pardon did not unite the country. And I'd say, actually, I disagree with that, because you have to say compared to what? All right. So, yeah, it wasn't all unicorns and rainbows after Nixon was pardoned, but it did allow the country to move on and not spend the next 2, 3, 4 years, relitigating Watergate and everything that would have gone with that. So I think arguably, again, compared to the alternative, that did help the country heal somewhat and move on. And that same could be true here if we are willing to move on from Trump. So, you know, you argue that sort of unity is impossible, or even getting better, it's just not going to happen. And maybe that's right. But, you know, Biden campaigned saying he was going to try for that. He's going to seek that, try to bring the country back together. More than half the country voted for that message. So maybe it can't happen, but I kind of prefer hope to despair, you know, that I'm not willing to say right now that it'll never happen. And so we might as well just be complicit in burning this whole place down, because no matter what we do, you know, nothing's going to work. So, but I think the best chance that we have is to look forward and working on what Biden wants to do for the country and not looking backward on what Trump did, at least in terms of a criminal prosecution. And then the final point was, I think Andrew, tongue-in-cheek, but paraphrase this one, well, what Trump did wasn't that bad. When I said there can't be an absolute bar, you know, if he killed someone or sold our top secrets to the Russians, you know, you'd have to say he could be prosecuted. But I don't know, Andrew, this one I thought was a little unfair, Andrew, I got to say. Yeah, the sort of tone of, I'm not mad, I'm disappointed. It's kind of, you know, parental. I'm just disappointed. I was kind of shocked to hear this, or I was surprised. Well, first of all, I didn't say it was that bad. Again, that goes back to the question of there's a lot of really, really bad stuff that isn't necessarily worthy of a prosecution. And then I'd say, yeah, in terms of serious enough to break this precedent and prosecute a former president, I don't think that OOJ, obstruction of justice, reaches that bar. Again, they didn't bother to impeach him. There are all these potential constitutional defenses. The obstruction was ultimately unsuccessful. You have to remember that. That's not a legal defense, but it's a relevant factor for a prosecutor in deciding whether to pursue a case. So this is not on the same level as treason or homicide, you know, when we're factoring in, again, the cost of actually indicting a president. And then the other example that Andrew talked about was Konstantin Kilimnik and the ties to the Russians and things like that. I guess in counter to my example about selling secrets to the Russians, again, I didn't say we don't want to look at it, as Andrew suggested. It's already been thoroughly looked at, actually, by the Senate and by Mueller. Again, that took place when Trump was a private citizen, remember. He wasn't a candidate, so he wasn't in a position to sell sensitive state secrets to the Russians. And again, if there needs to be more investigation, but I can't imagine what else you would do after a 1,000-page Senate report and the Mueller report. But if you think there needs to be more, it should be done by Congress, not by the grand jury. So the bottom line, everybody's mad. I get that. I'm mad. You know. But the only issue now is, what do we do, right? What's the best way to move forward? Stay angry for 4 more years or try to put this behind us and move on? And that's why I come down where I did. And with that, thank you, Dr. Hibbert.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case.
Excellent. The Simpsons quote, I think that's you.
Excellent debate tactic. Yeah
lawyer good. Playing to your audience there. Let me see if I can't kind of shape the issues here a little bit, because obviously, you know, I think we could drill down on any one of these and, you know, go for hours and hours.
And you'd better have a rebuttal Simpsons quote ready, is all I'm saying, Andrew.
We'll get there when we get there. So first, I want to talk about your four framing issues, because I think there's a lot of agreement and maybe some more clarity now. So I'm going to tackle these out of order, but in terms of things that I think are probably resolved. So what I think was your strongest argument in the framing issues is the pivot to we can have congressional investigations for areas that have not fully been litigated in the court of public right. opinion, and that a congressional investigation is better than a trial.
Before you go on, to be fair, it's not entirely a pivot. It is in the article.
It is. I want to be fair. So we're going to link the article in the show notes. I did a control F for Congress in the article, and it shows up once in the sentence, second to the last paragraph, that says, if necessary, Congress can hold hearings in support of such legislation, that is reform legislation, to expose more of Trump's misconduct. I think it's fair to say what you just argued in terms of robust congressional investigations is a stronger position than the one you took in the Washington Post. And again, we all agree on it. So I'm not accusing you of, you know, hiding the ball in the Washington Post article, but I don't think it's fair to say that we misread your article either. I think the Washington Post article says we're not going to prosecute Trump. Then there's a one sentence at the end that says, if necessary, Congress can hold some hearings. I think if we come to the position at the end of this show that says, hey, there should be robust congressional hearings into Trump's misconduct with an eye towards reforming future legislation, that's a significant point of agreement and one that I think is worth emphasizing.
Okay. Yeah. Let me make a point on this. I agree with that. And then also, if I want to quickly summarize the course of this argument, which is, you know, you write the article that's let's not go after Trump, essentially, and people, you know, reading it get the impression that it's like, let's not prosecute Trump. And then we do a response in which I say many times that I don't even feel like we have all the information. We don't know what's going on. We don't know all the possible misconduct enough to make that decision. And your response, which I think is important, and you make a good point, which is prosecuting, you know, grand jury, that kind of thing. That's not the way you get information out. That's not how you bring light to stuff. You know, that's more for Congress. Do I have at least roughly summarized your position correctly there?
Yes. Yeah, that's the main reason I brought it up. It's just that I know I understand and agree with the I want to know what happened sentiment. It's just that the criminal process is not the best way to do that.
Okay. So what I want to say to that is I hear you, but I still think that that's a little bit, I don't know what the proper word for it is. Maybe Andrew has the debate, whatever argument term for it. But my point still stands that, like, okay, you may be right that a congressional investigation is a far better tool for bringing stuff to light than prosecuting. But I would argue that until we have done all of that, until we have had Congress look into all that and we get a report that's not the Mueller report done by a Republican, by the way, somebody maybe who actually cares about fully getting to the truth, and we do a report like that, only then would I want to see an article written about how we should then not prosecute Trump. Because right now, we don't have that information. So while I agree with you that I agree with the point that prosecuting isn't the way to bring that stuff to light, we need to have that stuff brought to light first before we can even say we shouldn't prosecute him for this stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, I mean, the couple things in response to that. One is we already, at least in terms of the things we most often talk about, we already have a great deal of information in terms of things like the Mueller report, the things that are most likely criminal anyway. I mean, you've got emoluments and stuff. That's not going to be criminal. The COVID response is not going to be criminal. But in terms of potential criminality, we've got a lot of information already. I don't know how much more we need in those areas. But yeah, I mean, and I also said in the column, again, you know, I've only got 800 words in these things, so I can't go into every minutia, you know, but I did say in the column, absent some new revelation, you know, there's not justification to prosecute Trump now. Now, of course, if Congress does more hearings and we learn something new about Trump selling secrets to the Russians or whatever, then you've got to revisit that question. So I'm just talking about what we know now, in terms of whether we should start criminal proceedings now. I would definitely never rule out that if some new information comes to light, that that changes the calculus.
I guess, but, you know, okay, sure, emoluments maybe won't be criminal. There couldn't be anything in utilizing, you know, essentially getting government money into your business, funneling it into your business. Nothing there could be criminal. That all could be above board. There's no possibility for criminality there. Or, yeah, COVID response. Okay, what about bribes for pardons? Yeah. Nothing could be criminal there?
I've written multiple columns about how that could potentially be criminal if you can prove bribery again.
I guess, yeah. Okay. Well, but, I might be more objecting to the timing of this being the article. I know, you know, you only got 800 words or whatever, but like, what are we at? Do you think it's appropriate? We're at an appropriate juncture now to where we should be putting out this stuff of let's not prosecute Trump, or should we have this information first rather than writing something and saying, well, absent any new information, we shouldn't be prosecuting him?
Well, I think that's kind of nuance, isn't it? I mean, so we can say, okay, based on what we know now, we shouldn't prosecute Trump. If we learn more, maybe that changes. I mean, I don't think we're really disagreeing.
I think we're disagreeing on where, I guess, where our mindsets are. Because, like, my mindset, and I think go ahead.
Yeah, it sounds like you're implying we should do more criminal investigations. And that was sort of the tone of the podcast, I think. We should be doing more, like, we should be convening grand juries and doing more criminal investigations to get to the bottom of all these things. And I'm just kind of saying the reverse. Mm-hmm. We already know a lot. Most of what we know doesn't look likely criminal. Let Congress investigate more. And if something new comes to light, then you revisit it. But based on what we know right now, I don't think, you know, Biden DOJ on day one should be convening multiple grand juries to investigate the Trump administration.
I think we're agreeing to disagree here. I think I agree with what you're saying, which is important. That's what I was going to say about the mindset. For one, I don't believe that what I was saying was let's get a bunch of grand juries together to do this. I think you're right in your criticism that I was saying Congress should do this stuff, and that's not the same as prosecuting. I accept that. But my state of mind, I think a lot of states of mind of people who listen to the show, because you know we heard from a lot of people who agreed with me on this, is my state of mind is we don't yet have the information, and so this article is premature. Whereas yours is we have plenty of information. I'll stick the caveat in there that, you know, if there's some other revelation, I change my mind, but we have enough information to say, let's not prosecute. And I just think that's a genuine disagreement, and maybe I'm wrong, yeah. But so that's, I just wanted to summarize that.
Yeah. Friendly amendment. I'd say we have enough information based on the sort of most widely known allegations, the things like obstruction of justice, contact with the Russians before the campaign, things like that. And if we need more information, the way to get it is not through the criminal process.
Sure. That's agreed all. There. To okay. The last part, not to the first part. Go ahead, Andrew.
So I want to try. That was framing issue number three. I want to speak briefly on issues two and four. But then I kind of want to agree to the overall structure in which we're comparing the costs and benefits. So let me hit these super briefly because I think we're sort of articulate our positions, right? Position number four was that it isn't a binary or not binary thing that that Trump can be subject to civil liability or state prosecutions, which I don't know that I read that as consistent. I guess I read, you know, the case against indicting Trump as applying to both state. ASG.
Yeah, I don't
and if not, okay. If you don't, then good. Then we're in agreement on that. I would just add, for whatever it's worth, and it'll get factored into the overall calculus. The perception, and certainly as we look at the historical analog at this point, right? The historical analog is Ford's pardon of Nixon. Ford's justification was that I think broadly echoed by the language in your column, right? Which is that the country needs to heal and move on. We need to focus on what we need to do, to move forward, and this would be a distraction, but it was also punctuated by Ford saying and various defenders of Nixon saying, and Nixon's really suffered enough humiliation. Like, let's, you know, kind of not kick him while he's down. And I want to be 100% clear. I know you're not saying that. But I think with respect to that, he's also potentially subject to these additional bits of process. I think certainly the potential is there for that to reflect, right? For that to be seen a non-prosecution at the federal level to be seen as reflecting the same kind of, well, you know, he's suffered enough. And historically, that was in fact how that was perceived with respect to Nixon.
That's not what I mean.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Nixon pardon was extremely controversial as well, right?
For a lot of these things. We're going to talk about that,
right?
Yeah.
So, it's a lot of similar issues.
Yep. So, the idea that this is unique to the president, right? Like, I still think we're kind of in own goal territory. And again, if you look back at the Ford pardon of Nixon, right? One of the first responses to the pardon of Nixon was the head of the ABA saying, oh, well, did Ford also pardon all of Nixon's subordinates, many of whom are now languishing in prison as a result of having enabled Nixon's conduct? And I think that applies sort of with equal force here, right? I mean, less so because, you know, Stone's sentence has been commuted and Flynn has been pardoned. But like, you know, Manafort's still in prison. Papadopoulos still served his term, right? Like there is something chafing in a sense of justice for the idea that like the underlings suffer while the president is not indicted.
Yeah.
But again, I don't. That's not a major component of my argument, but that would be sort of my response to that on a framing issue. I do want to go back to what you led off with, which I agree 100%, but I disagree on how the calculation comes out, and that is, at the end of the day, what you're really doing is you're balancing two considerations, right? And the question is, right, are the costs of proceeding with a potential indictment of Donald Trump, do those outweigh the benefits, or is it the reverse? And I want to add parenthetically that the position I think I articulated on our show, but that I would want to make clear here, is the position that I would want neutrality, right? I would want direction from the Attorney General that says to the DOJ, to whichever prosecutor gets assigned to this. I don't want my thumb on the scale either way, right? I want to use the same standard we've been using since episode 13 when we went through Hillary Clinton's emails, right? Which is you use standard prosecutorial judgment. He doesn't get a pass because he was the president, but you wouldn't bring a case that you otherwise wouldn't bring against someone else simply because he's the president, right? Like in the same way, right, that Comey's statement with respect to Hillary Clinton was no reasonable prosecutor would bring a classified information case against somebody in this case.
Well, and can I also just say the obvious, which is Hillary was investigated for this? Like, that was the result of an investigation. Yep. The investigation decided no. And the real right. error there is Comey coming out and talking about it. That's the worst right. part. But I don't really think it would be that big of a deal if go back in history and instead of Comey doing that, they merely quietly investigated her and then determined there wasn't anything there. Is that some great violation of democratic norms that would have, brought the country to its knees? I don't think that's that bad of a thing.
Nope, yep. She wasn't the president either.
I mean, she was the first lady and also the far and away favorite to be the next candidate. But yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I view you as having made two kinds of arguments for the costs and the benefits, right? And those, I think, interact with each other. The first is what I might call like the reconciliation point, the appeal to the center argument, right? And so, quoting from your article, if there was an indictment, quote, we would remain bitterly divided with half the country convinced that Trump is being subjected to another political witch hunt. And then a little bit of an Elijah in here. Criminal prosecutions can't bind up this country's deep political and social wounds, right? So the first sort of benefits is in healing the country, in reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And then the second sort of benefits that I think you articulate, not quite drawn out as expressly, but having talked to you a lot, having had you on the show, I think would be a utility-based argument. And this is not an appeal to the center, but really an appeal to the left, right? Because the three of us are Joe Biden supporters. We are opposed to virtually everything the Trump administration did. We have said so in print, on the air. And the idea is that here I'll quote you again, the investigations, quote, would suck up all the oxygen and detract from Biden's message and policy agenda. We can't move forward if the next 4 years are spent relitigating the past four. Right. And so I view that sort of way of weighing the impacts as would this benefit or harm Democrats in being able to govern? So first, fair characterization on both of those two. Which I think are good goals, but I mean, we're talking about these are how we weigh whether prosecutions would be a good thing or a bad thing.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And obviously I liked the way you put it in point one of your opening statement. These two things could come into conflict, and that's what I think would make it a close call, right? So your view, you said, I think this is a close call, but I lean against prosecuting. And so the way, and I'm not suggesting that this is your analysis, but I think the way in which you get to a close call is if you think, for example, that if you were to indict that it would be good strategically for the Democrats, right, good on point two on the utility part, but would further polarize the electorate, right, you might say, you know, bad for point one, you might say, okay, these two things are in tension. The harms of point one probably outweigh the benefits of point two. But
can I just interrupt a second? Because I'm not sure I understood what you said a minute ago about indicting being good strategically for the Democrats. Because I never look at criminal indictments as a political strategy.
I think
your article. I'm glad you asked.
I think there are two questions with respect to that. Right. The first is, neither of us are saying that you bring the political question as the basis for the indictment, right? I'm saying you let prosecutors make a decision without a thumb being on the scale. And I think you're saying, want to be clear, that you would intervene and say, yeah, we're going to take this out of the realm of typical prosecutorial discretion in recognition of what you've described as the precedent of you don't indict an outgoing president.
Well, this is maybe a minor quibble. I wouldn't put it quite that way. Okay. I think what I'd say is these are my arguments about how you should exercise that discretion.
Mm-hmm.
It's predetermined.
Sure.
I'm saying, you know, these are the arguments which would cause me to come out this way, barring information that we don't currently have. You know, this is how I think that discretion should be exercised.
Understood. And I want to push back on that a little bit, but I do think we've both asked the question, how would a hypothetical indictment of Donald Trump, how would that affect President Biden's ability to get stuff done? Right.
Right.
Okay. And so that means we do measure the political implications of it. Right. And my point's, which I'll get to very, very briefly, are, I think by either measure, the one historical precedent that we have would tend to argue in the opposite direction. Right?
I have to make a point there. I'm so sorry. You keep talking about the one precedent we have. I really think we ought to enter into the record, as I mentioned in the episode, the precedent of Obama not going after any of the war criminals of the Bush administration and what that has done to the country in the wake of that. I think that is maybe even a more important precedent than Nixon.
I take that point. In other words, I think you could disagree with what I'm about to say, but still come out on your side, Thomas.
I wasn't arguing against you.
Yep.
You know, the wording you used of the one precedent we have. That's all.
Fair. But that is, from a precedential standpoint, doing something, right, is sort of easier to point to than not doing something.
But, well, his argument, if Randall's argument is for not doing something, I would argue that a precedent where they didn't do something is even more relevant.
Fair. Let me talk very briefly about Nixon. And you might have also added, Thomas, that like using the Nixon precedent is bending over backwards to apply it to Donald Trump, right? Like Nixon voluntarily resigned. He did not fight his way to the bitter end. His supporters did not try and invalidate the 1976 election, right? Like Nixon behaved far more charitably in a way that is far more respectful of the Republic than Donald Trump has and Donald Trump supporters have. But
much of which, again, also falls in the reprehensible but not necessarily criminal camp.
We can go down that.
So, it's a whole other show.
In terms of implications, number one, I think the evidence is super clear that Ford's pardon of Nixon accelerated partisan polarization, right? Like, far from healing the country, it divided the country into camps, right? Into that's my guy or that guy's a crook. And the statistical evidence for this is really, really good. I'll send you the article. There's a Pew Research study from 2014. It's entitled "The Polarized Congress of Today Has Its Roots in the 1970s." Right, and it draws upon the research of Keith Poole, Howard Rosenthal. They're the guys that invented DW Nominate. But without even
reading it, can I express skepticism? Because you can't test it. How do you test the alternative?
Sure, you're free. You're free to make the argument that we would have been way even more super duper extra polarized without it.
Exactly.
But I think that's got an uphill battle when you look at precisely sort of pre-pardon and post-pardon, right? So pre-pardon, 1973 to 1974, more than half of the House and a third of the Senate fit in what Poole and Rosenthal called the overlap zone, right? Which was in between the most liberal Republican and the most conservative Democrat, right? 240 House members, 29 senators. Within 10 years, that dropped to 66 and 10. So it dropped by a third. And then today, that's zero, right? There is no overlap between the most liberal Republican and the most conservative Democrat.
And again, I'm not a political theorist or, you know, I mean, it strikes me that you might have a correlation causation problem there. You know, those things happened. How do you actually pin them on Nixon's pardon versus on Watergate itself, for example, or on any number of social factors that could have contributed to that? I think you're asking the pardon to do an awful lot of work.
Well, but the same arguments apply to your healing the country point.
Yeah, that's the point, right? That at minimum, even if it's not an argument that the pardon caused polarization, it's strong reason to doubt that the pardon did much in the way of healing partisan divides, right?
And again, compared to what? We can't do a study, right? So we don't know.
No.
It's just logical to me that it's more likely. Maybe the reconciliation's impossible, like you two were suggesting, but which is more likely to lead to it? You know, the Biden DOJ spending the next 2-3 years going after Trump, or saying, let's try to move forward, let's try to heal some of these divisions, let's try to come together. And one way you do that is not, you know, give Trump another platform to yell witch hunt for the next 2 years before he starts his 2024 campaign.
Look, I agree whenever you're trying to argue by counterfactual, right? I want to cast doubt kind of on that, on the healing thesis. And then with respect to the intuitive argument, I think what we can look at is we can look at the way in which Ford's pardon of Nixon was perceived at the time. And I have to tell you, as somebody who was either not born or not politically active through this, like I hadn't realized just how bad this was, right? Like, and part of that is sort of the inevitable hagiographication that occurs when something, you know, recedes into distant memory, right? I mean, Nixon got an obit in the New York Times instead of, you know, Woodward and Bernstein showing up to pick at his funeral, right? But it's astonishing to me when I went to look into it how unpopular the pardon was at the time, and how much it really undermined Ford's presidency, right? So cutting to the chase, I mean, Gerald Ford has said, and I'm going to give some of the supporting evidence, but Ford has said he thinks the reason he was not reelected to serve a second term in 1976 is because he pardoned Richard Nixon. And, you know, there's sour grapes or whatever, but I think the evidence is pretty good on that, right? So,
but I believe he also said he still felt it was the right thing to do.
Oh yeah, he absolutely did, but I think he's wrong on that.
Not the alternative would have been worse.
I agree. We're going to tackle that, but let's look at the harm that this caused, because I think, right, these are equivalent potential harms that Joe Biden could face. So Gallup ran a poll September 6th through 9th, 1974, which found that the public opposed pardoning Richard Nixon 53-38. Nixon was pardoned in the middle of that on September 8th. Those numbers stayed stable but went down over the next 2 years. So by the 1976 election, it was 55-35 opposed. Ford's own press secretary, J.F. Terhorst, resigned in protest the day afterwards, said, I didn't know anything about this. I think this is terrible for the country, and I am resigning. I can't work for a president who would do this. Shockingly to me from the historical record, because this is somebody, Randall, that you and I will recognize as a chief villain from the Reagan administration, Ford's chief of staff, Al Haig, of I'm in charge now fame, said, quote, the president Gerald Ford, was alone when he pardoned the President Nixon. His staff was, to a man, against it. Right. So it was, and again, Haig may have some self-serving things there, and I would not want to put Al Haig on the stand as a witness. This was radically unpopular within the Republican Party, radically unpopular within the public at large. Looking at the Gallup analysis, they say in analyzing their own poll data contemporaneously, Ford's job approval rating suffered as a result of the Nixon pardon. He began his term in office with very high ratings, 71% approval ratings. By the end of September, that was August of 74, by the end of September, only half of Americans approved. By the end of the year, his approval rating dipped to 42% and averaged 44% for the rest of his administration.
And back then, that used to be bad.
So I think that that is to suggest, and I go through the data because I am sympathetic to the argument that says, that there's kind of a move on contingent, right? That there is the way in which you reconcile is by saying, all right, well, that happened, but the bad man's gone and he'll die soon, so it's done, right? But I think we also have some historical precedent, and maybe this dovetails with Thomas's point on George W. Bush, for no, wait, this is still an open matter, and not bringing it to a close, right? Not allowing us to achieve some kind of notion of finality is also deeply unsettling. And I think you know this as a former prosecutor, right? That's often the only thing you can offer to victims of crime is to say, hey, we had a public trial, right? We got this out and we achieved a resolution. So
yeah. I mean, I don't think we're disagreeing. I don't think we're disagreeing that much. I mean, I guess I'm more skeptical than you are about how much we can draw from a 50-year-old precedent of Nixon. And there's also a slightly different dynamic involved, and I have to think through how it affects it. But of course, that was still a Republican Department of Justice, so it would have been, the Ford Department of Justice going after him, not the opposing party going after him after he left office. And that makes it different. We'd have to think about how exactly, but it's not a pure precedent for that reason as well. But again, I just think what I said earlier, I think blaming, the political divisions over the last 50 years and assigning that primarily to the Nixon pardon seems to me potentially too simplistic.
And if I were doing that, I would agree.
And we're going to have to cut in here. We went an incredibly long time with Professor Randall Eliason that challenges the limits of bandwidth and Google Drive and episode length in general. And by the way, our esteemed editor's time, I'm not going to say who it is, but whoever the genius is who edits our shows
can only do so much. They are amazing.
Yeah, they are great. It can only do so much in time. So here's what we're doing, everybody. Sorry to interrupt. We're going to do part two of this debate next week. But if you are one of our fine patrons at patreon.com/law, you will get access to that early, very early, not instant, because, there's a lot of editing involved in this two-hour debate.
It is a two-hour, yeah.
Yeah, but you will get it way early. So if you sign on to patreon.com/law, we will release that episode early. For everybody else, terribly sorry, but that is going to be, it's a cliffhanger. You'll have to tune in next week for the thrilling conclusion of our debate.
I mean, could you believe it when Randall Eliason said, oh, wait, sorry.
Oh, no, you better not. Oh,
can't give it away.
Nope, can't give it away.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE answer time. Okay, Andrew, let's find out if I porked my streak, but in a good way. Here we go.
Yeah, this was a question about the risk of loss in a contract for deck chairs, right? So long, confusing fact pattern, but essentially, man looks through a catalog, calls up a manufacturer, says, I want you to make me four of these desk chairs. Later, changes his mind, sends an email, it's not opened. The manufacturer makes the chairs, sends them out, but they get damaged in shipping. And then the man, you know, gets these chairs he doesn't want that are broken, shows up on his doorstep and says, well, I'm not paying for this. Manufacturer sues him. And the question is, who is going to prevail in the lawsuit for breach of contract? You went with D, the man, because the chairs were damaged in transit. And for that to be the correct answer, what would have to happen is that the risk of loss would have to stay with the manufacturer from manufacturer to acceptance, right? It's the manufacturer's fault that the chairs were damaged in transit. Yeah, not going to beat around the bush here. The answer that stuck in your craw as I've kind of heard of this, but ultimately you did not go with was B, the manufacturer, because the risk of loss had shifted to the man. And that is in fact the correct answer.
God, I almost,
you were thinking about it and
somewhere in my mind, I remembered like, for some reason shipping, like risk of loss shifts when you ship it or something. It doesn't make any sense to me, but yeah. Well, explain yourself, Andrew.
Yep. So, okay. Most importantly, there is a valid contract here, right? Like the man's efforts to rescind do in no way invalidate the contract. So then the question is, who has risk of loss? A carrier contract is formed when a third-party carrier carries your goods. Carrier contracts can be either shipment or destination, which affects the risk of loss. Shipment contract generally does not require the seller to deliver the goods to a specific destination, and it is the default when a contract is silent regarding the other terms of delivery. So that's what we have here. In a shipment contract, the seller must get the goods to the carrier, make appropriate arrangements for shipping, and notify the buyer of the shipment. If the seller does this, it is not liable for any of the damage that occurs during transit. So that's the difference between shipment versus a destination contract, right?
Yeah.
This contract is a carrier contract, right? Third party is delivering the goods, not the manufacturer. It becomes the shipment contract as opposed to a destination contract because the contract is silent. So that's the default. Yeah. The manufacturer got the goods to a third party shipper, made all the arrangements, notified them. The manufacturer not responsible for losses that occur in transit in that case. This is another one of these, and I never really appreciated it how much in law school, but my contracts professor would often say, like, you know, we would be talking about X or Y, and he would say, like, but at the end of the day, like, the contract's going to specify, right? Like, this is the kind of thing that, you know, you don't just sort of leave silent and say, oh, what did they do in 13th century Saxony? Oh, this is a shipment carrier contract? Like, you know, this is the kind of thing that the terms will specify.
The important lesson here, though, is that if it's silent, then for some stupid reason, we put the burden on the buyer to, like, work it out with the shipping company, which makes no sense to me at all, because that relationship is a one-time deal. When somebody, if there's a shipping company that ships something to me, I'm like, what? Who are you? You've ruined my goods. Now I need to interact with you and get the money back. Versus the company that arranged the whole thing, chose that shipping company. They don't have to deal with it. That seems completely backwards to me. And that it sucks, because I did remember something about that. And it just... But in my mind, I was like, well, it specifically brought up the fact that they made the arrangements. So I thought that would be enough to, you know, maybe swing it the other way. But gosh, this is, I did not pork my streak. Pork the streak, Thomas. I haven't done
it. I know.
I'm still pork.
Yeah, it's meant to sort of draw the line. I think you've analyzed this exactly correctly, right? Like, which is that the default rule is meant to draw the line of, well, it does, but it's meant to say, hey, when can the manufacturer have peace of mind, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when can they say, all right, we've done everything we have to do. And the default rule is, if we get it, if we arrange for shipping, nothing says anything otherwise, then once we get goods to the whoever's going to ship it, and you know, we've paid them and done our due diligence. Now it's out of our hands. Now the risk shifts to
I'm
you
so
as the
glad
buyer.
Finally someone's thinking reason. Of the poor manufacturers in these situations and not the customer.
Well, again, no, it's
just wrong, but I also got it wrong. I have not porked my streak. I need to pork my streak. And now since I haven't porked it, here's the sad music. Wrong!
Hide my head, I wanna drown my sorrow. No tomorrow, no tomorrow.
You lose!
All right, Andrew, hop in your time machine and change the law so I got this one right. No, all right. Hi, tell us who actually got it right.
You know, Thomas, this week's question was so difficult that I'm going to pick a non-winning answer that illustrates a point you and I didn't even talk about, but helps illustrate exactly how tricky this question is. So LC is the winner. That is at LCMPBLL, a bunch of characters with no vowels on Twitter. And LC writes, C, the UCC requires contracts for the sale of goods over a certain amount of money to be in writing. I believe $600 is over that amount. It doesn't sound like there was a writing until the email canceling the order, so no contract existed. Well, this analysis, like yours, is absolutely perfect, except for one tiny little bit. So I thought that this was great. Yes, UCC requires that contracts for the sale of goods over $500 be in writing. But what does be in writing mean? It means that there must be some written evidence that indicates the quantity of the goods purchased and is signed by the party to be charged. You see where this is going. That's why they put in all of those details about the email that the man sent. He said, I am no longer interested in purchasing the 4 chairs from you that we agreed upon yesterday. I'm sorry for the inconvenience. And he signed it at the bottom. So sending the email, even though it was never opened and never read, and even though it was backing out of the contract, was actually the thing that verified the contract, that satisfied the statute of frauds. So it is, in fact, B is the correct answer, but all of the lawyers who worked through and thought it was C, I think that's very, very understandable. I think it goes to show you just how hard the bar is. And congratulations, Elsie. You helped us work through this question. Even if you didn't get it right, you're still this week's winner. And everyone, give them a follow. That is at the letters LCMPBLL. And congratulations on being this week's person who expanded the discussion of T3BE.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats, over on patreon.com/law. And Andrew, I think it's your turn.
Thank you, too. I support 5 podcasts on Patreon, but I only changed my name because I love you, OA Clown Horns. By the way, I have to say I love hearing our Hall of Fame and other patrons on other folks'
shows. On other shows?
Oh, it's the best.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah. So thank you, I Support 5 Podcasts. 2, Sparkle Donkey Tequila, the world's best tequila in the world, sparkledonkey.com. I went there. It looks good.
I love that tagline. Yep.
2, Read Cynical Theories by Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay. Yeah, I would agree with that. Like, borrow it from the library and read it so you understand how terrible those arguments are. That fair plug. Amy Coney Barrett reminds me of Nurse Ratched. Yeah, I think all of us. Next week on Law and Awful Movies is the trial of the Chicago 7. I am paying you to watch Sorkin. I don't hate Aaron Sorkin. Anyway.
I do.
Yeah, well, then there we go. 2, Noctelfa Root Creeper of the St. Louis Root Creepers. The Coterie, expert Salesforce implementations and custom app development. Find out how to transform your business digitally. The WWW runs out, so look for The Coterie. Justice for Beer. Check out Budget Botanist on Fiverr for all your virtual houseplant needs. Listening for years, still can't come up with something clever. Nevin Dudez's Cow. Chelsea Olson, Wesley Glenn Brock, becoming a patron to get 5 episodes a week. Now to catch up on months of backlog. Yeah, there's a lot out there. New book, The Greatest Gift of All, A Logical Path from Religion to Humanism by Mark McLean. Out December 30th. Pre-order now. Wear a mask and wash your hands with soap from Kiss My Grass Soapery. At Casa Agri is the best brewery. At Emperor's Brewery is a close second. Bradford Rudy is fogging the mirror with his other loose end Keaty. Groot Dooku tree, a thorny tourney of torn and tawny tourniquet attorneys, each more torn and tawny than the last. Thomas Kleberg, Big Docket Energy, do not hug your local public defender, there's a pandemic. Mary Perez, a sentient mass of spiders got a new job in the oil industry, please vote blue and make me lose my job for real. Buddy freaking Geyers. Idea for a screenplay, Air Bud, man's best amicus. Hadron, sorry for not changing my Patreon name, 1L finals are a clown horn. I always call meme set before deallocating your memory, I like freeing totally clear. Two fabulous lesbians, that's all they wrote. William Drew Collins, Bob Newhouse, Sassy Italy Tours is asking you to donate to the Raphael Sassy Memorial Fund at www.raphaelsassymemorialfund.org. That's RAPHAELSSIMEMORIALFUND.org. Greg Kreimer, and now a thank you to our sponsor, Ritz-Carlton Roofworks. Looking for an event space? They got you covered. Biden-Harris 2020, now to win the Georgia runoffs. Yeah, listen up. Jennifer Chakowski, doing this while drunk. Hey, Hans Royal, you're live on the air with opening arguments. I'm a simple country hyper chicken. Mike Hall, an old, mad, blind, despised, and dying king. That Dickens, always with the compliments. One day, a Biden shall rise from our ranks and use the power of the Matrix to light our darkest hour. Say it with me, amicus. I'm not even a tortfeasor and I'm kicking your ass. Support secular construction. There is no rule against faithless erectors. That is a great pun. Angry Macface. Sorry, Andrew. Uncle Frank is too far gone. Well, if it isn't my old friend, Mr. McGreg, with a leg for an arm and an arm for a leg. Center Black Trans Sex Workers, the Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019, came for the Stormy Daniels, stayed for the string of never-ending clown horns. If you start an advent calendar on the 27th of December, it counts down to Inauguration Eve. I am actually doing that, so I think that's an awesome idea. Crazy Corgi. Well, yeah, not as crazy as my Corgi. If everyone listened at speed 1.3, they would find Thomas's music is even more exciting and inspirational. Not even Giuliani's hair dye wants to sit and listen to him rant. Change my Patreon name so that I don't jump every time you read it. Murray Gregerson, what do judges need to make a good ruling? Clear jurisdiction. I move for a bad court thingy. I became a patron because this is the best podcast ever. Aw, well, you flattery will get you everywhere, including an extra time on your line there. Can you imagine the secrets that turkey knows to get a pardon? Jordan G. Jessamine, in Illinois, we pronounce it Illinois. If you're reading this Patreon name, then I'm already dead. Wow. At infinity, putting a pin in this patron name for later. Brent Medling, Jake Braun, I'm too sexy to vote Trump, too sexy to vote Trump, Trump needs to be reimpeached, I'm a lawyer, you know what I mean. Christopher Brown, Philly Live Show 2022, I'll bring the scotch and the cheesesteaks. Oh, you know that. Lawful Copter says, Andrew and Thomas, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for everything you guys do. Oh, well, thank you so much for that, Lawful Copter. The wheels of justice turn faster than the speed I change my Patreon name. Vote for Ossoff and Reverend Warnock in Georgia again. Oh, man, I really porked my T3BE streak, didn't I? There's a goat. Why is there a goat? Andrew Seidel's butt wishes the SCOTUS had fewer plague rats. Genuinely surprised, Trump never tried to nominate Stone Cold Steve Austin for defense secretary. Zirkle, let me drink lots of water. I like peeing totally clear. Odin the Law Dog, Josh Hoku, blackout orders violate my religious freedom to draw Nazi bombs down on a whole London neighborhood. Polly Hernandez, the previous patron name is true. The next patron name is true. Check out Ring Runner and Brigador on Steam, two slightly mad indie labors of love that do not deserve their obscurity. Ring Runner and Brigador. Well, there we go. Mongo just want Ruby back. Please wear mask. Emily Rainbow Spence and not that Chris Wallace. Thomas, take it away.
Thank you to Alfred Wallace. Oh, interesting. We got not that Chris Wallace and then Alfred Wallace.
Presumably the 19th century affair. Biologist. Yeah, that would be great.
GiveToModestNeeds.org, GiveToModestNeeds.org. I knew who Sidney Powell was before she gave a worse presser than Giuliani is a weird flex, but here we are. That is such a signature OA listener flex, though. I love it. Jason Copas, Hotspear asks that you don't refer to Michael Flynn as the turkey. That's foul language. Free Melania, optimism is overrated. 8 equals 8 equals D.
But 8 equals 8 equals D, doesn't that
Yeah, what is that?
8, 4?
Yeah, I'm not sure what you're constructing there, like Goro or something? Like what? Anyway. dealing with Republicans is playing prisoner's dilemma with someone that always betrays you. Drop ethics, go with game theory. The true Conrad Michaels, Nate Drex, Darth Mandypants, four crack and total lawsgiving, lawsuit dismissal services conveniently located between your favorite funeral and sex needs. No idea what emotion lemonade is, but it sounds delicious. 13th century sexy gravel truck lawyer. I am the bad things that happen in Philadelphia. Stay gritty. Diogenes the Cynic was right. Jennifer Cratch. Araz Conpoyo is my fave ACP. Attorney-client privilege is a close second.
Nice.
Unionized Brooklyn friends. This timeline just keeps getting dumber and dumber. CivilPoliticsRadio.com Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Good job on the voting for Joe Biden. Please continue the hand-washing. Stephen Balticate Sandoval, John Bilderbeck, Louis Gohmert's COVID tooth is the hanging chad of 2020, Philip Kaiser, Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious, can I get back to criticizing religious influence on our democracy yet? By Dawn 2020, SCOTUS grabbed POTUS by the scrotus. Absion, Payne Struppet, Trambulus, thank God she finally changed her stupid Patreon name. My big sis is a flat earther. Little sis is anti-vax. How are my baby sis and I the only sane ones? Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Jonathan, Trump wanted four seasons, got Doubletree. The second best patron, vote for at Pope Hat as the next guest. Oh, Milo Mead song is stress eating. This episode sponsored by the law firm of Season and Season. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. B-word McConwell. Yeah. I only take Viagra because of my faithless erection. James K., Therese Chan, doctor at night, homeschooling kids in the day. Pretty sure my wife's a superhero. Chad T., anonymous. Biden should name everyone Trump fires between the election and inauguration to his transition team. WordOrigins.org. Professional copy editors and types editors setters use only one space between sentences. Take that, Andrew. In the end, it was more like Iran-Contra than Watergate. R.I.P. Notorious RBG, video killed the Patreon pun, an undisclosed senior government official from an undisclosed red state, oui oui croissant escargot omelette du fromage, Derek Trump pardoned three turkeys this week, congrats Corn Cobb and Michael Flynn, terrified will be pecked to death by lame ducks, a string of unpronounceable characters, Rhonda wants the most boring 2021 possible, the coronavirus apocalypse is making me too depressed to think of anything clever this week, Adam Costa, Jay Aldenwalt, Malika Chandler, Tricicular Manslaughter, Dr. Young's Ideal Rectal Dilators, okay, Soggy Pants, Matthew Vernon, I just had COVID and losing the Senate, the Seattle live show is still the worst part of 2020. Aww. Aww. We love that, but also sorry to hear that. The first nurse in the world to administer Pfizer vaccine outside a trial is an immigrant. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. De jure belly et pacis at last, baby. Heather L. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium. Ian and Ally, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, David in Brooklyn. Goofus tries to commit treason while Gallant accepts election results. Sam Danow, Mitchell, no commute, so behind on podcasts. Andrew, I'm beginning to think Sidney Powell may not be a good attorney. And Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute. I agree with that 100%. Sam Buck and Conrad Michaels.
Woo!
Woo! Thank you so much, top patrons. And that's our show. Oh, man. What a debate. Can't wait to get to part two. It's going to be super exciting. I wish there was any way to get to that early.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. There might be. Okay, that's our show. Thank you. See you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at OpenArgs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.